Jews knew how to survive, and now we've returned. Do you know how Jews still survive? They survive in the text. The art of composing is one that comes through some kind of nearly divine channel, divine inspiration, but it's depicted as the immediate, intense reaction to pain and loss and anxiety and suffering. That, at least, is the art of writing for Agnon. Everything about him, from his name to his date of birth to the date of his aliyah, his arrival in the land of Israel, everything was mythologized. Everything was part of the fable the author crafts about his own identity. Creativity, in all its forms, is the most authentic Jewish response to pain, to catastrophe, to exile, to destruction. Welcome back. This evening we are studying Agnon's great epic novel, The Bridal Canopy, in Hebrew, Hachnasat Kala. Of course, the bridal canopy refers to the chuppah, the canopy under which bride and groom are wed. The title bridal canopy is, of course, a kind of liberty that the translator took from the original Hebrew, which is hachnasat kala. Hachnasat kala is a rabbinic idiom which means to bring the bride under the canopy, but it is used in the more general halachic sense, in the Mishnaic sense, of the dowry which is required to enable a young couple to begin their life together. So hachnasat kala is much more connected to these ideas of what it takes to actually get the bride and groom to the canopy. This story has a very interesting genealogy of how it came about and how it came to the version that we have today, both in Hebrew and in English. It began in 1919-1920 as a serialized story published in a periodical, which, when taken together, is a kind of very long short story, or maybe novella. I guess it depends on how you count it. And then the story grew in the telling. It's what's called a frame story, or an accordion tale, which can be stretched. And because within the frame story, you can insert all types of independent fables and tales and legends that resonate with the larger themes, the story can be, well, it can be ever expanded. And that's exactly what happened. So that if you go back to the original version of the story, which is quite short relative to the final version, you see that the frame, the skeleton of the story is all there, already present in the original form. But Agnon took stories, some of which were originally published as standalone tales, and he embedded them like jewels into the crown of the bridal canopy. The 1931 edition, which appeared as the centerpiece of the first edition of Agnon's collected writings, is a much more fleshed out, fully formed work. It is, to some degree or another, a novel. And already in 1937, the book was translated to English. Agnon's publisher, Mr. Shokin, understood that if you want to have a world-class author, somebody who, I don't know, maybe a committee sitting in Stockholm might take note of when they're coming to decide who to give a prize to. Well, if he's left in Hebrew, no one outside the small provincial shores of the land of Israel will really take note of him. So Shokin pays to have the novel translated already in 1937 into English. It was a rather curious episode. It was translated by a man named Israel Meir Lask, I.M. Lask, who was a fairly prominent translator, literary translator of both Hebrew and Yiddish literature to English. He was a journalist. He worked at the Palestine post-British born, but he lived here in Israel, in the land of Israel, and he worked in the Palestine Post, the precursor of the pre-state Jerusalem Post. And somehow the novel was selected by, published by Doubleday in America. It was selected by the Literary Guild of America. It was a kind of Book of the Month Club as its selection. This was a kind of every man's library. People subscribed and received that month's selection in the mail. And one wonders what the Iowa farm wife who, as a kind of aspirational endeavor, subscribed to the Literary Guild of America, what she made of this story, which is set 110 years earlier, 120 years earlier, in the world of Galician Hasidut, in the world from which Agnon came, in the world of Reb Yudel Chosid of Brody, our protagonist. The translator, knowing that the American audience was going to find this rather odd, that the world that's being depicted, early 19th century Orthodox, European Orthodox Judaism, included a foreword which was excised from later editions of the book, which is describing to the American audience, what is this world of Hasidim v'anshei ma'aseh, the pious, holy, traditional world of European Jewry? But what's equally remarkable is the fact that in 1937, when our Iowa farm wife is first reading the novel, the world that's depicted, even though the plot is set 110, 120 years earlier, but the world that's depicted was to a very real degree still extant. A traveler from Iowa to Krakow or to Brody or to Rohatyn would have encountered actual living Jews who looked like they walked right off the pages of Agnon's tale. This is before, only a few years before, but it is before the great destruction of that world. At a certain point in a later edition of the collected works, Agnon expanded the work by about 20%. Unfortunately, the English edition was never retranslated. We are in serious need of a new English edition of The Bridal Canopy, but the lack of 20% of the Hebrew edition does not do as much damage to the translation to the English text as you might imagine. Because what did Agnon do? He further stretched the accordion and added in more individual stories, but the outline of the plot is still there. The story itself is a kind of tale of wonders. It's an oxymoron. It's a sophisticated folktale. It's both highly naive, but profoundly subtle. It's an ambivalent parody or satire of the world that it depicts. It's ambiguous. It simultaneously accepts and rejects the old traditional world that our characters live in. And therefore, the prejudiced reader will see the side of it which he or she may automatically identify with coming to the story. Sometimes the way you read the story says more about you than it says about the text. Again, set around 1820 in and around the city of Brod or Brody in what today is eastern Ukraine, we encounter the Galicia as this main character, Reb Yudel. Yudel is just a Yiddish diminutive of the name Yehuda or Judah, but Reb Yudel Chosid, Reb Yudel the pious, and his world. It's a world completely informed and almost entirely closed to within the world of tradition. And even though at the time that the story is set, there were other forces at play in the world, Reb Yudel seems naively ignorant of them. The world that he knows is the world that he occupies. There is no strife that's introduced into the tranquility of the plot outside of the struggles that the character himself undergoes, mostly as a byproduct of his poverty. The aspect that had been subject to sometimes very biting criticism at the pen of other Yiddish and Hebrew writers is here treated softly, is here treated gently. Things such as romantic love versus arranged marriages, which were, of course, the subject of great biting satire by other writers, here is viewed much more delicately. Poverty and social, cultural, class struggles, similarly, here it's done in a different kind of register. With Agnon, the parody is, in this case, not in every work of Agnon, but in this case, the parody is gentle. It's loving. It's not at all bitter. Reb Yudel, the impoverished character who succeeds, who is redeemed in the end, is never broken. He remains intact as a character, as a literary character, and as a religious personality. Agnon's turning to the past, Agnon's taking his reader back to a society 100-some-odd years before he's writing it, is really surprising in light of what some of his contemporaries and what some authors that preceded him had done to that world. Agnon is not a shill for tradition, but neither is he attempting to undermine it. And the ability of an author to both skewer and sacralize, to be sympathetic to, and to also poke at, is, well, it's really the most Jewish form of humor. I again mention our great teacher, Professor Ruth Weiss, whose wonderful book, No Joke, which explores Jewish humor, of course, will tell you much more about this, about how that ability to see both sides, which here for our purposes, as I've told you last week and the week before, is the most typically Agnonian approach to kind of transmit multiple, sometimes contradictory messages with the same word, with the same sentence, is very typically the heart of Jewish humor. Think of Purim, right? Purim becomes a quite significant symbol both on the surface and between the lines of the bridal canopy. What happens at Purim? Purim, the righteous Jew who takes everything seriously, who reveres the holy, who shows respect to the learned. Well, on Purim, it's no holds barred. We take out all the stops. And the same figures of reverence the other 365 days a year can be sent up in the most bawdy of manner on that one day a year. I remind you, of course, that Purim is also the day of topsy-turvy, where the plot is sometimes turned on its head at the very last minute. Salvation arises from sometimes unexpected places and always at the last moment, as any good storyteller knows. It's a story of mistaken identity, of confused identity, of double identity, of masks, not in the biblical text of Esther itself, but in later iterations of how Purim develops, the idea of masking, of carnival, of everything being turned around is very endemic to Purim and something which is, of course, very apparent here. The plot itself, the frame story itself, is somewhat straightforward. It takes on its shaggy dog aspect only because of the presence of all of the very many stories. It's clearly patterned on classical Hasidic tales. We have this kind of decorative opening title, which, if, by the way, if you read the novels of Dickens, if you read the novels of Mark Twain, you'd recognize this kind of chapter headings, book one, chapter one, Ish Hasid Haya, there once was a Hasid. The following story deals with a devout man, a chassid, who was so poor as to be overborne by his poverty. May mercy deliver us. but who always sat at the holy toil of Torah, because he kept his distance from the current affairs of the world. So he had no commerce, nor traffickings, nor dealings like other folk, but found his entire delight in God's Torah, both the generally revealed and that which is held secret, to wit, the lore of the Kabbalah, the teachings of Jewish mysticism. He served the Lord in awe and fear and love and never thought of acquiring honor through study or of being esteemed a scholar by himself or others, nor yet of his own advantage in assuring himself a portion in the world to come. He studied to fashion a seat for the divine presence, kedei la'asot kisei la'shchina, and to no other end whatsoever. This idea of fashioning a seat for the divine presence is a Kabbalistic idea. It's a metaphor that when we perform righteous deeds, when we study Torah, when we pray, when we are virtuous in this world, we invite God to join us at our table, as it were. To fashion a seat for the divine in this world means to create space in the physical world for divine presence to enter. Agnon is speaking here mystically and theologically, but he's also speaking ironically. It's a perfect example right here in the first paragraph of his well-known novel. It's a perfect example of how he can be doing both at the same time. He is making a profound theological statement quite sincerely, but he is also doing it completely ironically. The story goes on to explain how. This Reb Yudel's dwelling was underground in a damp, narrow, gloomy cellar, lacking seat upon which to sit and table at which to sit, bed upon which to lie, and all other household furniture save a straw mat spread out on the ground. Upon it his folk would lie, never moving thence by night or day, so that their garments might not spoil even more. This chassid, who through his righteous devotion to God and his study of Torah and prayer is fashioning a seat for the divine, he is inviting God to join him at his table, he is so poor that he doesn't even have a chair to sit on. He has to sit on a mat on the floor. He has no table. He has no chair. He and his household sit on a mat on the floor, and they're careful not to brush around too much because the abrasions of this rough mat on top of his dirt floor would ruin the only suit of clothing that he has. So poverty-stricken was he that his only property was one cock called Reb Reveli. He has a rooster. The rooster in Hebrew is called Rabbi Zarach. His name is Rabbi Zarach, who rouses him to serve the Creator, because of a verse in Psalms that God rallies light through the darkness for the upright. Zarach b'choshech or li'asharim. Zarach, zoreach, means to shine forth, to rally the light. God causes the light to come up, the rooster cockadoodles doos, and Reb Yudel knows it's time to run off to the synagogue for morning prayer. So his rooster is called Rabbi Zarach, right? Why is he Rabbi? Because in the old world, every simple Jew is a rabbi. He's not a rav. He's not a great rabbi. He's certainly not a Hasidic rebbe. But even the simplest Jew is attributed with that honorific rabbi. Right? And even the rooster of the simplest Jew is afforded the title. The translator has again taken a liberty by anglicizing the name to preserve the pun. In Hebrew, he's Rabbi Zarach, because with the shining of the sun, the rooster cock-a-doodle-doos. And in English, he's called Reb Reveli, you know, right? To rouse him to the service of the divine. His only possession is this Reb Reveli. Now, later, when Reb Yudel is sent off on his journey, on his quest, the whole time he's worried about poor Reb Reveli, because Reb Reveli left behind with his three daughters and his wife, who are literally starving to death. Well, you know, Reb Reveli, he has a use as the chassid's alarm clock, but he might also have use in the chicken soup pot. And for a starving family, that might be a better use of poor Reb Reveli. And like, you know, Chekhov's pistol introduced in the first act, by the third act, he must be fired. But wait a little until we get to the fate of Rabbi Zarach. The story goes on. Ere his cock was done crowing, this poor chassid would speed to the house of study. His prayers ended, he never dashed away, as do the gluttons, to fill his frame with perishables and corruptible things which increase the flesh and the worms that later feed thereon. But he would sustain his intellectual self on the story of the manna and the like. When his desires rebelled and turned too strong towards matters of food and drink, he would subdue them with a page of Gemara. The story of the manna from Exodus chapter 16 is the story of how God sustained the Jewish people in the desert with the divine bread from heaven, the manna. There is a custom, not too widespread in our day, that at the end of the morning prayers, a person should recite those verses of the manna. It's a kind of segula, a kind of charm in which we remind God that he is tasked with our sustenance. He is tasked with helping us provide for ourselves by reminding him of how he sustained the Israelites in the desert with the miraculous manna. So what does a normal person do after the morning service? He returns home. He has a cup of coffee, a buttered roll, some breakfast, fried eggs. But what does Reb Yudel do when the cupboard is bare? He has no breakfast to return to. So he needn't feed himself with his fried eggs, because he can fill his belly with the spiritual recitation of the story of the divine manna. And if his hunger gets too much, well, he can quench that hunger with a page of Gemara. Now, this depiction of the chassid who has nothing, who has no income, who has no wealth, who can't provide for himself, and also, we must imply here, can't provide for his hungry family either. For him, the turn to the page of Talmud is not abandoning his responsibilities. Within his worldview, forget about our worldview. Forget how we judge such a lifestyle. Forget how Agnon the author may be judging it. But Reb Yudel himself, the turn to the page of Talmud is an act of spiritual energy. The question, quite simply, is Reb Yudel naively but admirably pious, or is he simply ridiculous? The story sustains both readings. Reb Yudel himself understands that God runs the world. And when there's a conflict between God's word and will and the world as it appears to us, we ought to align ourselves with the word over the world. The question is not why Reb Yudel is starving to death. In his eyes, the question is, what need he do in order to be worthy of God's divine beneficence so that he will be saved? Reb Yudel understands that God runs the world, and he, therefore, must be worthy and righteous and virtuous so that God's miracles may be performed upon him. Well, now this chassid was charged with the care of daughters, each older than the next, by a year or more. This Gitale, the youngest, was about 17. And then came Bluma, her sister, who was about 19. And the oldest of all was Pesela, the firstborn, about 20. Now, to be a 17-year-old, to say nothing of a 20-year-old girl, in this place at that time, and to have no husband, was already to raise an eyebrow. Ragged and barefoot they went without proper clothing or garments, so they stayed at home. Perforce, they never showed their faces in the street. And they were all charming, graceful, and fair, with well-grown breasts and well-grown hair. But within their hearts, alas, fluttered despair at the days of their youth that were almost done. But redeemers from their maidenhood, there were none. The translator has paralleled the rhyming Hebrew couplets in the original text. The story goes on. When the youngest reached the age at which a virgin should be wed, Frumit, the wife of this chassid in question, began to address herself to her husband. "How much longer," said she to him, "will you be as unfeeling as a raven toward your children? Have you no pity for your hapless, hopeless daughters, who sit sighing and weeping like wives whose husbands have vanished, and who know not whether they are widowed or not? Why, the girls have all but wept their eyes away, and the hair on their heads is turning white, yet you sit there like a lump of clay in form of man, without lifting a finger to marry them off." Like so often in Agnon's writings, the man is passive, he is acted upon, and the women are really the forces to be reckoned with. Well, what do you do when you have a problem like Rebudel? Frumit, ever the practical one? Well, she does what a good Jew does. She goes to the rabbi. She goes to the Hasidic rabbi of her sect. That is an actual historical figure, Rabbi Avraham Yoshua Heschel, the rabbi of Apta, the Apta Rav, who is a historical character. He was the great-great-grandfather of Abraham J. Heschel, for whom Heschel was named, the great 20th century philosopher. And the rabbi tells Reb Yudel, it is time to go out and raise money for a dowry to marry off your daughters. And a certain amount of startup cash is put forth in order to hire a wagon and a wagoneer to take Reb Yudel off on the highways and byways and villages of Galicia to raise the dowry for his three daughters. But we can't send him out looking as he does. He's scrawnier than his own rooster. So they take a pillow in order to pad his stomach, because even a schnurrer, even a beggar, needs to look respectable. And they outfit him with a proper kaftan that doesn't look quite so run down and patched up and threadbare. And they send him off with his Sancho Panza, an idea I'll come back to momentarily, for a long volume's worth of adventures. The rabbi gives just one instruction. You're not only looking for a dowry, you're also looking for a bridegroom. And when you find the boy to marry off to your pesele, his father is going to pledge a certain amount towards the dowry. Whatever the father of the groom pledges, you, Reb Yudel, should match. Penny for penny. That is my instruction. Reb Yudel, the trusting chassid, does not question the rabbi, and off they go. They head out from their town, and they're off, and adventures begin. I'm going to cut it short. I advise you to read the whole story. And there are many wonderful tales, such as the one we sent you about the mouse and the rooster, not connected to the rooster we met earlier. It's a kind of standalone folk tale, but if you read that story or reread it, you'll understand how it fits in with the larger frame. It's a story of the righteous being rewarded, the wicked being punished, that there is some kind of divine justice at work, and that everybody, including the mice, including the roosters, get what's coming to them. And if God should provide for the little mice, how much more so will he provide for his righteous and worthies? After a few months on the road, they come to the town of Rohatyn, which is about 100 kilometers from Broyd, where they set off. In the annotated edition of Hachnasat Kala, the only such volume of Agnon that we have a full annotated edition prepared by Professor Avram Holtz, with maps and illustrations and footnotes and excursus on the footnotes. It's a wonderful book in Hebrew for those that want to make their way into the Hebrew text. We find the geography of every place. Everything is exactly accurate. If Agnon tells us it took a half a day's journey from point A to point B on that road, you can trust Professor Holtz that indeed that is exactly what it would have taken. But when they get to Rohatyn after a couple of months on the road, Reb Yudel has collected only 200 gold coins. How much is 200 gold coins? I'm not sure. but it's not enough to marry off three daughters. But it's more money than Reb Yudel even thought existed in all the treasuries of all the crowned heads of Europe put together. He's never imagined so much money, let alone held it in his purse. So they get to the inn at Rohatyn, and he's got all of this money. And he thinks, if I have so much money, if suddenly I have this wealth, well, it's immoral for me to go on begging. And not only that, well, you know how travel is a curse. You know, all those weeks and days on the road, it makes it very hard to get to synagogue to pray with a minyan. It makes it very hard to sit and study the Talmud hour after hour. He's been negligent in all of his religious duties. And after all, those religious duties are the source of merit by which God will save him from his troubles. So having reached Rohatyn with 200 coins in his purse, he decides he's going to set up in this inn, and he's going to sit, and he's going to study. The townsmen are perplexed. Who has the luxury to sit in a hotel studying the Talmud if not a wealthy man? Now, you understand, this is the Jewish imagination at work. What luxuries does wealth afford? What does Tevye sing, after all? You remember Tevye. If I were rich, I'd have the time that I lack to sit in the synagogue and pray. And I would learn the holy books with the learned men 7 hours every day. That's the imagination of what I would do with my wealth. I wouldn't buy fancy cars. I would have a real tin roof, but my wife would have a proper double chin, and I would be freed of the burdens of livelihood in order to dedicate myself to prayer and study. So therefore, the townsmen all assume that this fellow staying in our inn must be a wealthy man. But not only is he a wealthy man, word gets out that he's looking for a bridegroom to marry his daughter. But here we see the Purim-esque, the carnivalesque at full work. Our chassid's name is Reb Yudel, Yehuda. When he gets called to the Torah, his name is Yehuda ben Nosson, or Natan. Jews, particularly poor Jews in those days, did not have family names. And even if they had family names, they were not in wide use. But if he had a family name, his name, ben Natan, would have been Nathanson or Notanzon. It happens there was a Yehuda Notanzon in Galicia, a historical character living at this time in Brody, in Reb Yudel's hometown. Yehuda Notanzon was the wealthiest Jew of his age. And our Reb Yudel, the son of Natan, the son of Nosson, who's sitting and learning like only a rich man can do, is mistaken for the wealthy Yehuda Notanzon, this great, fabulous magnet. You know, if you look in your local phone book, I bet there's a William Gates, a Bill Gates, living somewhere in your area code. It's not such an uncommon name. How many Bill Gateses must there be in America? Could you imagine you're a schnorrer and you're going door to door collecting for some charity, and you get to a door and on the door it says, "Welcome to the home of Bill Gates." You figure you've made it. This is it. What are the chances? Well, Mr. Gates opens the door and you immediately realize this is not the Bill Gates you were imagining. This is Bill Gates the butcher, or Bill Gates the shoemaker, or Bill Gates the water chopper, or Bill Gates the gravedigger. This is not the Bill Gates of Apple. So there's this mistaken identity here. When they hear that he's in the market for a son-in-law, the line is going around the corner. Everyone wants to marry their son off to Yehuda Natanzon. Along comes Vovi Shor, a very wealthy man, and his son, Sheftel, who looks like a very nice boy. And he offers a shidduch to Reb Yudel, and he pledges 12,000 gold coins as his share of the dowry. Reb Yudel is delighted. He'd be very happy to join families with this man. They shake hands. They drink olachayim. And Reb Yudel, for his part, matches the pledge. 12,000 gold coins from his side as well. In months on the road, Reb Yudel has managed to raise only 200 coins, which is more than he ever imagined existed in the whole world. And here he makes a pledge for 12,000 gold coins? What's going on? It's important to know that the piously naive Reb Yudel is not trying to connive anyone. This is no con job. He is fulfilling God's divine will. He's not trying to trick anyone. And it's important to note also that Reb Yudel himself is completely unaware of the mistaken identity and the Purim spiel that's going on all around him. He has no idea that they have mistaken him for anything other than what he is. How could he have possibly pledged 12,000 gold coins? He is just doing the work of a righteous chassid who fulfills the instructions of his rabbi. The rabbi had told him, when you find the son-in-law, you match the pledge of the mechutin. You match the pledge of your in-law. They shake hands. Reb Yudel goes back to his hometown with the promise that the family of the groom will make their way in good time, and the wedding will be arranged in the town of the bride. This is the end of part one of book one, and book two goes on to the return back to Brody and what happens. When Reb Yudel returns to Brody, he tells his family that a match has been arranged, but does not elaborate on the details. Frumit is not all too clear how this is all being financed, but good news is nothing that we should raise our eyebrows at. On Purim, in Reb Yudah Natanzon's home, the poor have gathered to receive their charitable gifts, the Matanot Le'evyonim, which are traditionally given out on Purim. And our Reb Yudel has come as well to collect his charitable gift from the wealthy Reb Yudel. And all the while, there's a Purim spiel going on. And in this Purim play, in this comedic, parodic Purim play, there's a character whose name is Reb Yudel. Because you see, the tales of Reb Yudel have already spun out into the realm of legend. Because Nota, his faithful wagoneer, had returned as well to Brody, and perhaps over a glass or two of something to drink at the local inn, was spinning and exaggerating all of the fantastical stories that had happened to them along the way. This, by the way, is a leaf picked up straight out of Don Quixote. Don Quixote, which is often considered the very first novel, Don Quixote, which is set 200 years before Hachnasat Kala and written 300 years before Agnon put pen to paper, is also a work with two halves. And by the time we get to the second one, Don Quixote, this character, is living in a world in which the tales of Don Quixote have already become the stuff of legend. We'll come back to the Man of La Mancha momentarily. So at the Purim spiel, we have the rich Reb Yudel. We have our poor Reb Yudel. We have the Reb Yudel who is not Reb Yudel, but is playing Reb Yudel, telling the exaggerated tales of Reb Yudel, when along comes a gift basket from the in-laws. The in-laws back in Rohatin send Mishloach Manot, the traditional gift basket of foodstuffs, to their in-law. When it arrives with the delivery man in Brody, addressed to Yehuda Natanzon, it gets misdelivered to the wealthy man, who is quite surprised that his in-laws are giving him a gift, because not only has he not arranged a marriage with them, he actually, in fact, has no children. So the whole thing is something of a puzzle. when the in-laws do arrive and they find, really, this is something almost out of a Marx Brothers movie, when they find our Reb Yudel in his true form, back to his patched threadbare clothes, sitting on his dirt floor, they're outraged. They've been swindled. It's a scam. How are you going to pay $12,000? What's going on? We thought we were marrying. Reb Yudel calms them down. He says, listen, why don't you come over for dinner? We'll talk it out. We'll work it out. He goes home. He tells Frumit, the Machatenim are coming for dinner. She says, are you crazy? She doesn't even have two turnips to rub together. How is she going to make a dinner for her prospective in-laws? Well, it's like a bad episode of I Dream of Jeannie or something. You know, the husband is bringing the boss home for dinner with no notice and something has to be thrown together. So what does a Jew do when they're in trouble? They go to the rabbi. Frumit goes to the Abta Rav, to Rav Heschel, and she says, you got me into this trouble, you got to get me out of it. And the Abta Rav says, oh, Rabbi Zarach, it is time for Rabbi Zarach to stick his neck out for the family, to take one for the team, and Rabbi Zarach should become the dinner that you will serve. The rooster, in Hebrew, there's an interesting linguistic turn. In Hebrew, a rooster is called a gever. Gever also means a man. There are all types of reasons that roosters might be associated with masculinity. I remind you of the very English name that appeared at the beginning of the translation. In many ways, the rooster is more of a man than the man is. Reb Yudel allows events to act upon him. He is a person of faith. He is a person that understands the world is being controlled by the divine. But he is barely an actor in his own tale. The rooster, with the shochet's knife at his neck, with the slaughterer's knife of Damocles hanging above his head, does the only reasonable thing. He runs away. While the daughter is trying to carry the rooster off to the butcher, he gets loose and he runs. She chases after him. He runs into the forest. She's on its heels. He goes into a cave. She follows. And in the cave, what do we find? All of the riches you can imagine. Gold and silver and diamonds and rubies and pearls and jewels. A veritable Aladdin's cave. And they're saved. It's a miracle. Much more than 12,000 gold coins. Reb Yudel is able to marry off all three daughters and provide for charity. And in the end, Reb Yudel and Frumit themselves go off on Aliyah to settle in the land of Israel, which is, of course, completely anachronistic because in the 1820s, Jews from Galicia, by and large, were not going off on Aliyah. This was seen, actually, in the 1930s as a kind of Agnon retrograding the Zionist ideology of the 20th century back into the 19th century. No story of redemption can be complete if we were to leave Reb Yudel there in the diaspora. In order for the salvation to be fulfilled, we have to somehow relocate him to the land of Israel. The novel was criticized for its Deus ex machina ending. You know, Deus ex machina, this idea from a Greek drama that sometime at the end of the play, the Zeus or the other god would be lowered by some pulley onto the stage. The machina, the machine, right, would lower the god onto the stage, and the god being divine and having divine powers can tie up every loose end, can fill in every unexplained plot point. Later, after Greek drama, literature came to view that with a jaundiced eye. It was too neat to have a kind of supernatural explanation to get yourself out of the plot you may have painted yourself into the corner of. And the rooster, well, I always call it not Deus ex machina, but a rooster ex machina. And it raises the question of, well, what kind of miracle comes about through poultry? How is this all happening? Right? And how are we to understand it? Particularly since all throughout the novel, the narrator and Reb Yudel himself have planted the seeds of doubt. All throughout their journeys in the towns and villages and highways and byways, Reb Yudel and Nota are often recalling that in ages past, when there would be a pogrom or an uprising and Jews were endangered or in trouble or were kicked out of one village and sent to someplace else, they would often bury their wealth under a tree, beneath a rock, inside a cave, in the hope that if they should survive the wicked sword, they would come back to recollect their wealth and their treasures. And as they're going along the paths of Galicia, Reb Yudel is conscious that, for all he knows, they're trotting on untold hidden wealth that was not reclaimed, because not every Jew returned from the afflictions and banishments and pogroms. And if only they would know where to look, their troubles would be over. They would have all of that wealth. So even though we, the reader, know that there's a perfectly prosaic explanation for what this pot of gold is doing in the cave, nevertheless, it is seen as being very clearly the work of divine salvation. It is hashkacha. It is divine providence at work. The miraculous reversal of fortune is essential to, well, it's essential to the traditional folktale, and here it's used in a kind of complicated way, but in the traditional folktale, it's essential because it is an affirmation of all is right in the world. The wicked are punished, the righteous are rewarded, God is running the world, everything is as it should be. The agnonic parody here is because we don't know how to interpret it. Reb Yudel can sincerely, if naively, maintain his belief and understanding of how events have unfolded, and we are invited to see it from both ways now. Well, you know, this raises all types of questions. And it, of course, reminds us of other depictions of poverty, of desires for wealth, of hope for salvation, of dreaming, if I were a wealthy man. And of course, our mind immediately goes to the writings of Shalom Aleichem and to Tevye. And oy vavei, if you only know Tevye from having seen Fiddler on the Roof on the stage or the screen. You really do owe it yourself to go back to the source material. You know, again, I'll mention Ruth Weiss, whose course is available to you in the Tikva archives, her wonderful course on the Tevye stories. You know, she's not such a fan of Fiddler on the Roof because of the way it deviates and subverts Shalom Aleichem's message. But nevertheless, I mean, you know, we all love the play and the film. And it is available to us in a wonderful translation by Hillel Halkin as Tevye the Dairyman. And you owe it to yourself to read it in English, in Yiddish, if you're able. Tevye, Shalom Aleichem, were quite different than Reb Yudel and Agnon. Long after he had written Reb Yudel, Agnon said the following to his friend Aleph Mem Haberman: "Consider what I did with the pauper Reb Yudel Chosid in my novel, The Bridal Canopy. I created him as a person of substance, with charm after his own fashion, despite the events that befell him. What would our other writers have done with a character like this? Mendele would have made him ridiculous in order to twist and poke. Shalom Aleichem would have made him the object of simple mockery. I sweeten the bitterness of Reb Yudel's poverty, removing the ridicule, making the pauper a more perfect character, although clearly it would be better if we were not paupers." Now, Tevye Tevye is not like Reb Yudel. Tevye is a tragic figure. Agnon's story here ends, really does end happily ever after. It is, we should note, quite unusual. Agnon's tales do not usually end happily ever after. Agnon's tales often end, well, we don't know exactly what happens in the end. We'll see more of that in our final session. Tevye, certainly in the source material, but even in the film, is a tragic figure. Reb Yudel is a comic figure. Regardless of our critique of his lifestyle or of his faith, we can't help but rejoicing in his salvation. Tevye maintains a critical trust in God. Reb Yudel maintains a blind trust in God. Tevye is constantly arguing with God, discussing with God. Right? Tevye doesn't pray to God as much as engage God in the kind of back and forth debate. Of course, Reb Yudel is actually a very learned person. I mean, he's not a great rabbi, but he is indeed a learned person. And there is no source that Tevye keeps in his pockets like so much sugar cubes for his horse. There is no source which Tevye, biblical, Mishnaic, Talmudic, or otherwise, that Tevye doesn't somehow butcher into a malapropism, sometimes for his own purpose and sometimes against his own benefit. Reb Yudel is resigned to his destiny. But because Reb Yudel is resigned to his destiny, he understands the events going around him as being exactly what he deserves. He doesn't try to buck it, doesn't try to argue with it. And therefore, for Reb Yudel, what happens to him is a miracle, the natural, that which can be explained through a perfectly prosaic, natural, historical explanation, is in fact miraculous because it is natural, because it is happening to him. And just as his troubles happen to him naturally, so too his salvation. Now, we have to make reference to one other great classic work, which I've alluded to earlier, and that, of course, is Don Quixote, which no doubt served as some kind of model and template. There he is. I love the fact that in southern Spain, they repurpose Picasso's iconic illustration of Don Quixote as a stop sign to make sure that tourists won't go tilting at those windmills. But really, there is something so, I mean, for us inherently Jewish and Israeli about the character of Don Quixote, which is from the 19th century has been translated numerous times into Yiddish and into Hebrew. The great Hebrew poet Chaim Nachman Bialik himself translated Don Quixote, abridged it and translated Don Quixote already in 1912. And Agnon certainly knew Don Quixote from a variety of different sources, and there can be no doubt that there is an influence of one on the other. But I want to focus on really only one particular matter, and that has to do with the presence of reading and books. Generally speaking, when making one's way through the canon of Agnon, you would be well served to be attentive to the presence of books. Books as physical objects. Agnon was an inveterate bibliophile, and those of you that will come to visit us at the Agnon House will see his quite impressive library. Among the greatest tragedies to happen to Agnon, perhaps the greatest tragedy to happen to Agnon, was that he twice lost his library, once to a house fire, and then after it was rebuilt to the pogroms, the Hafraot Tarpat, the Arab uprising in 1929 in which his house was marauded. These are ideas that return again and again in the autobiographical layers of his stories. But the presence of books and the depiction of the act of reading, engaging with the written word in holy texts, written word in secular texts, is a very significant symbol in Agnon's entire canon. But both Don Quixote and Hachnasat Kala share this emphasis on the influence of books and reading on the protagonist. Don Quixote is a satire of the kind of chivalric literature, the tales of knights errant that go off conquering giants and dragons and winning the love of the fair maiden, righting wrongs and dreaming the impossible dream and fighting the unconquerable foe. For Rabiudel, it's also the book. But for Rabiudel, it's the books of Torah study, of Talmud Torah. They also encapsulate a worldview. Don Quixote reads these tales of knights going off and doing great deeds, and he, although a kind of middle-aged, broken-down fellow with rusty armor and an old nag as a horse, imagines that he can go and win the hand of fair Dulcinea. He doesn't see the world as it is. He sees the world. He sees himself as filtered through the fantasy of the literature he has read. Rabiudel, too, sees the world as filtered through the works he has been reading, or in the Yiddish expression, we would say, learning, studying. He understands that God controls the world. And if he will align himself with God's will, God's will be acted upon him. And if there is a dissonance between the word and the world, he will stay with the word, and knowing that the world will bend itself to God's will. This is the source of the idea present throughout the bridal canopy of the victory of spirit over flesh, over physicality. Rabiudel doesn't need to eat breakfast because he can study a page of Talmud. Rabiudel understands that the most important physical manifestation in his tumble-down basement hovel is to create a metaphorical chair, seat for the divine. Don Quixote is a tragedy. I mean, it's full of the most humorous of passages, but it's a tragedy. Don Quixote is a tragic figure. Rabiudel is a comic figure. After all, the novel ends with a wedding. We know from Shakespeare, the comedies always end in weddings. The tragedies end in the graveyard. The comedies all end with weddings. But Agnon couldn't leave well enough. If indeed he gives us a happily ever after ending in the bridal canopy, well, there was something wicked about the man. He knew that Jewish history has too much tragedy. 90 years after Rabiudel, his great-great-great-grandson, Yitzhak Kummer, the protagonist of a different novel, sets off on Aliyah as part of the wave of the second Aliyah, that heady decade before World War I, in which many Jews came to the shores of Jaffa, Agnon among them. And Rabiudel's great-great-grandson, Yitzhak Kummer, who is aware of his heritage, comes off on Aliyah, but he has a very hard time. He's impoverished. He's hungry. The reading the chapter of the manna does not fill his belly. He struggles. He struggles with his faith. He struggles between the old world and the new. He struggles between Jerusalem and Jaffa. He struggles between a righteous girl who he's interested in and a less virtuous girl in Jaffa, right? He's torn between these things. And all the time, as he's struggling, before he meets a very tragic end, his name is Isaac. And the symbolism of the binding of Isaac comes back in full force at the end, but without the angelic reprieve at the end saying, "Stay your hand." You can read the novel. It's available in English as "Only Yesterday," in Hebrew as "Tmol Shel Shom," in English as "Only Yesterday." But all the time, Isaac is remembering his Elta Zaidi, Rabiudel. And he knows the tale. He knows how poor Rabiudel was miraculously saved at the end. And he keeps thinking, I could use a miraculous salvation. But he knows he won't receive it, because he knows in order to be miraculously saved, you need to first believe in miracles. And the faith of Reb Yudel has been diluted over the generations. The early 20th century is not the early 19th century. And Yitzchak, the descendant of Reb Yudel, is not saved. But Reb Yudel himself, if we stop reading in The Bridal Canopy, does indeed live happily ever after. Yitzchak is a constant reminder that miracles no longer happen like they did for Reb Yudel, simply because we can no longer see the world as Reb Yudel did. But the bridal canopy is a time capsule. It allows us, the outside reader, no matter what our position, no matter what our critique, no matter what our objective view is, to see and experience the world as Reb Yudel does, and even to come to love him for it. The replacement key reminds him, you can't go home again. You can't go back to the house of study when the values and the traditions of the house of study are no longer in force and valued.